Book 4, The Book of 101 Things a Boy Can Do. Tepic had expected what? Possibly the splat of flesh hitting rock? Possibly, although this was on the very edge of expectation, the sight of the old kingdom spread out below him? He hadn't expected chilly, damp mists. It is now known to science that there are many more dimensions than the classical four. Scientists say that these don't normally impinge on the world, because the extra dimensions are very small and curve in on themselves, and that since reality is fractal, most of it is tucked inside itself. This means either that the universe is more full of wonders than we can hope to understand, or, more probably, that scientists make things up as they go along. But the multiverse is full of little dimensionettes, play streets of creation where creatures of the imagination can romp without being knocked down by serious actuality. Sometimes, as they drift through the holes in reality, they impinge back on this universe when they give rise to myths, legends, and charges of being drunk and disorderly. And it was into one of these that you bastard, by a trivial miscalculation, had trotted. Legend had got it nearly right. The Sphinx did lurk on the borders of the kingdom. The legend just hadn't been precise about what kind of borders it was talking about. The Sphinx is an unreal creature. It exists solely because it has been imagined. It is well known that in an infinite universe, everything that can be imagined must exist somewhere, and since many of them are not things that ought to exist in a well-ordered space-time frame, they get shoved into a side dimension. This may go some way to explaining the Sphinx's chronic bad temper. Although any creature created with the body of a lion, bosom of a woman, and wings of an eagle has a serious identity crisis and doesn't need much to make it angry. So, it had devised the riddle. Across various dimensions, it had provided the Sphinx with considerable entertainment and innumerable meals. This was not known to Tepic as he led you bastard through the swirling mists, but the bones he crunched underfoot gave him enough essential detail. A lot of people had died here, and it was reasonable to assume that the more recent ones had seen the remains of the earlier ones, and would therefore have proceeded stealthily. And that hadn't worked. No sense in creeping along, then. Besides, some of the rocks that loomed out of the mists had a very distressing shape. This one here, for example, looked exactly like...
"Halt!" said the Sphinx.
There was no sound but the drip of the mist and the occasional sucking noise of you bastard trying to extract moisture from the air.
"You're a Sphinx," said Tepic.
"The Sphinx," corrected the Sphinx.
"Gosh, we've got any amount of statues to you at home."
Tepic looked up, then further up.
"I thought you'd be smaller," he added. "Cower, mortal," said the Sphinx, "for thou art in the presence of the wise and the terrible."
It blinked.
"Any good, these statues?"
"They don't do you justice," said Tepic, truthfully.
"Do you really think so?"
"People often get the nose wrong," said the Sphinx. "My right profile is best, I'm told, and..."
It dawned on the Sphinx that it was sidetracking itself. It coughed sternly.
"Before you can pass me, O mortal," it said, "you must answer my riddle."
"Why?" said Tepic.
"What?"
The Sphinx blinked at him. It hadn't been designed for this sort of thing.
"Why? Why? Because I will bite your head off if you don't. Yes, I think that's it."
"Right," said Tepic. "Let's hear it, then."
The Sphinx cleared its throat with a noise like an empty lorry reversing in a quarry.
"What goes on four legs in the morning, two legs at noon, and three legs in the evening?"
said the Sphinx smugly. Tepic considered this.
"That's a tough one," he said eventually. "The toughest," said the Sphinx. "You never get it."
"Ah," said Tepic.
"Could you take your clothes off while you're thinking? The threads play merry hell with my teeth."
"There isn't some kind of animal that regrows legs that have been..."
"Entirely the wrong track," said the Sphinx, stretching its claws.
"Oh. You haven't got the faintest idea, have you?"
"I'm still thinking," said Tepic. "You'll never get it."
"You're right,"
Tepic stared at the claws. This isn't really a fighting animal, he told himself reassuringly. It's definitely over-endowed. Besides, its bosom will get in the way, even if its brain doesn't.
The answer is... a man, said the Sphinx. Now, don't put up a fight, please. It releases unpleasant chemicals into the bloodstream.
Tepic backed away from a slashing paw.
Hold on, hold on, he said. What do you mean, a man?
It's easy, said the Sphinx. A baby crawls in the morning, stands on both legs at noon, and at evening an old man walks with a stick. Good, isn't it?
Tepic bit his lip. We're talking about one day here, he said, doubtfully. There was a long, embarrassing silence.
It's, what's the name? A figure of speech, said the Sphinx, irritably, making another lunge.
No, no, look, wait a minute, said Tepic. I'd like us to be very clear about this, right? I mean, it's only fair, right?
Nothing wrong with the riddle, said the Sphinx. Damn good riddle, had that riddle for 50 years. Sphinx and cub.
It thought about this.
Chick,
it corrected.
It's a good riddle, Tepic said soothingly. Very deep, very moving, the whole human condition in a nutshell. But you've got to admit, this doesn't all happen to one individual in one day, does it?
Well, no, the Sphinx admitted, but that is self-evident from the context. An element of dramatic analogy is present in all riddles, it added with the air of one who had heard the phrase a long time ago and rather liked it,
although not to the extent of failing to eat the originator.
Yes, but, said Tepic, crouching down and brushing a clear space on the damp sand, is there internal consistency within the metaphor? Let's say, for example, that the average life expectancy is 70 years, okay?
Okay, said the Sphinx in the uncertain tones of someone who has let the salesman in and is now regretfully contemplating a future in which they are undoubtedly going to buy life insurance.
Right, good. So, noon would be age 35, am I right?
Now, considering that most children can toddle at a year or so, the four legs reference is really unsuitable, wouldn't you agree? I mean, most of the morning is spent on two legs. According to your analogy, he paused and did a few calculations with a convenient thigh bone, only about 20 minutes immediately after 00:00, half an hour tops, is spent on four legs. Am I right? Be fair?
Well, said the Sphinx.
By the same token, you wouldn't be using a stick by 6 p.m. because you'd be only, 52, said Tepic, scribbling furiously. In fact, you wouldn't really be looking at any kind of walking aid until at least 9:30, I think.
That's on the assumption that the entire lifespan takes place over one day, which is, I believe I have already pointed out, ridiculous.
I'm sorry, it's basically okay, but it doesn't work.
Well, said the Sphinx, but irritably this time. I don't see what I can do about it. I haven't got any more. It's the only one I've ever needed.
You just need to alter it a bit, that's all.
How do you mean?
Just make it a bit more realistic.
The Sphinx scratched its mane with a claw.
Okay, it said doubtfully. I suppose I could ask, what is it that walks on four legs,
metaphorically speaking, said Tepic.
Four legs, metaphorically speaking, the Sphinx agreed, for about 20 minutes, I think we agreed? Okay, fine. 20 minutes in the morning, on two legs.
But I think calling it in the morning is stretching it a bit, said Tepic. It's just after midnight. I mean, technically, it's the morning, but in a very real sense, it's still last night. What do you think?
A look of glazed panic crossed the Sphinx's face.
What do you think? It managed.
Let's just see where we've got to, shall we? What, metaphorically speaking, walks on four legs just after midnight, on two legs for most of the day,
barring accidents, said the Sphinx,
pathetically eager to show that it was making a contribution.
Fine. On two legs, barring accidents, until at least supper time, when it walks with three legs.
I've known people use two walking sticks, said the Sphinx, helpfully.
Okay, how about when it continues to walk on two legs or with any prosthetic aids of its choice?
The Sphinx gave this some consideration.
Yes, it said gravely. That seems to fit all eventualities.
Well, said Tepic.
Well, what? Said the Sphinx.
Well, what's the answer?
The Sphinx gave him a stony look and then showed its fangs.
"Oh, no," it said. "You don't catch me out like that. Think I'm stupid. You've got to tell me the answer."
"Oh, blow," said Tepic.
"Thought you had me there, didn't you?" said the Sphinx.
"Sorry.
You thought you could get me all confused, did you?"
The Sphinx grinned.
"It was worth a try," said Tepic. "Can't blame you. So what's the answer, then?"
Tepic scratched his nose.
"Haven't a clue," he said, "unless, and this is a shot in the dark, you understand, it's
a man."
The Sphinx glared at him.
"You've been here before, haven't you?"
it said accusingly.
"No."
"Then someone's been talking, right?"
"Who could have talked? Has anyone ever guessed the riddle?" said Tepic.
"No."
"Well, then they couldn't have talked, could they?"
The Sphinx's claws scrabbled irritably on its rock.
"I suppose you'd better move along, then," it grumbled.
"Thank you," said Tepic.
"I'd be grateful if you didn't tell anyone, please," added the Sphinx coldly. "I wouldn't like to spoil it for other people."
Tepic scrambled up a rock and onto You Bastard.
"Don't worry about that," he said, spurring the camel onwards. He couldn't help noticing the way the Sphinx was moving its lips silently as though trying to work something out.
You Bastard had gone only 20 yards or so before an enraged bellow erupted behind him. For once he forgot the etiquette that says a camel must be hit with a stick before it does anything. All 4 feet hit the sand and pushed. This time he got it right. The priests were going irrational. It wasn't that the gods were disobeying them. The gods were ignoring them. The gods always had. It took great skill to persuade a jelly baby god to obey you. And the priests had to be fast on their toes. For example, if you pushed a rock off a cliff, then a quick request to the gods that it should fall down was certain to be answered. In the same way, the gods ensured that the sun set and the stars came out. Any petition to the gods to see to it that palm trees grew with their roots in the ground and their leaves on top was certain to be graciously accepted. On the whole, any priest who cared about such things could ensure a high rate of success. However, it was one thing for the gods to ignore you when they were far off and invisible, and quite another when they were strolling across the landscape. It made you feel such a fool.
"Why don't they listen?"
said the high priest of Teg, the horse-headed god of agriculture. He was in tears. Teg had last been seen sitting in a field pulling up corn and giggling. The other high priests were faring no better. Rituals, hallowed by time, had filled the air in the palace with sweet blue smoke, and cooked enough assorted livestock to feed a famine. But the gods were settling in the old kingdom as if they owned it, and the people therein were no more than insects. And the crowds were still outside. Religion had ruled in the old kingdom for the best part of 7,000 years. Behind the eyes of every priest present was a graphic image of what would happen if the people ever thought for one moment that it ruled no more.
"And so, Dios," said Kumi, "we turn to you. What would you have us do now?"
Dios sat on the steps of the throne and stared gloomily at the floor. The gods didn't listen. He knew that. He knew that of all people. But it had never mattered before. You just went through the motions and came up with an answer. It was the ritual that was important, not the gods. The gods were there to do the duties of a megaphone, because who else would people listen to? While he fought to think clearly, his hands went through the motions of the ritual of the seventh hour, guided by a neural instructions as rigid and unchangeable as crystals.
"You have tried everything?"
"Everything that you advised, O Dios," said Kumi.
He waited until most of the priests were watching them, and then, in a rather louder voice, continued,
"If the king was here, he would intercede for us."
He caught the eye of the priestess of Sarduk. He hadn't discussed things with her. Indeed, what was there to discuss? But he had an inkling that there was some feeling there. She didn't like Dios very much, but was less in awe of him than were the others.
"I told you that the king is dead," said Dios.
"Yes, we heard you, yet there seems to be no body."
"Oh, Dios, nevertheless we believe what you tell us, for it is the great Dios that speaks, and we pay no heed to malicious gossip."
The priests were silent. Malicious gossip, too. And somebody had already mentioned rumours, hadn't they? Definitely something amiss here.
It happened many times in the past, said the priestess on cue. When a kingdom was threatened or the river did not rise, the king went to intercede with the gods, was sent to intercede with the gods.
The edge of satisfaction in her voice made it clear that it was a one-way trip. Kumi shivered with delight and horror. Oh, yes, those were the days. Some countries had experimented with the idea of the sacrificial king long ago. A few years of feasting and ruling, then chop, and make way for a new administration.
In a time of crisis, possibly, any high-born minister of state would suffice, she went on.
Dios looked up, his face mirroring the agony of his tendons.
I see, he said. And who would the high priest then?
The gods would choose, said Kumi.
I dare say they would, said Dios sourly. I am in some doubt as to the wisdom of their choice.
The dead can speak to the gods in the netherworld, said the priestess.
But the gods are all here, said Dios,
fighting against the throbbing in his legs, which were insisting that at this time they should be walking along the central corridor en route to supervise the Rite of the Undersky. His body cried out for the solace over the river. And once over the river, never to return. But he'd always said that.
In the absence of the king, the high priest performs his duties. Isn't that right, Dios?
Said Kumi. It was. It was written. You couldn't rewrite it once it was written. He'd written it. Long ago. Dios hung his head. This was worse than plumbing. This was worse than anything. And yet... and yet to go across the river...
Very well, then, he said. I have one final request.
Yes? Kumi's voice had timbre now. It was already a high priest's voice.
I wish to be interred in the...
Dios began, and was cut off by a murmur from those priests who could look out across the river. All eyes turned to the distant inky shore. The legions of the kings of Djeli Baby were on the march. They lurched, but they covered the ground quickly. There were platoons, battalions of them. They didn't need Gurn's hammer anymore.
It's the pickle, said the king,
as they watched half a dozen ancestors mummy-handle a seal out of its socket.
It toughens you up.
Some of the more ancient were getting over-enthusiastic and attacking the pyramids themselves, actually managing to shift blocks higher than they were. The king didn't blame them. How terrible to be dead and know you were dead and locked away in the darkness.
They're never going to get me in one of those things, he vowed.
At last they came, like a tide, to yet another pyramid. It was small, low, dark, half concealed in drifted sand, and the blocks were hardly even masonry. They were no more than roughly squared boulders. It had clearly been built long before the kingdom got the hang of pyramids. It was barely more than a pile. Hacked into the door seal, angular and deep, were the hieroglyphs of the Ur kingdom.
Kuft had me made the first.
Several ancestors clustered around it.
Oh dear, said the king, this might be going too far. The first, whispered Dil, the first into the kingdom. No one here before but hippos and crocodiles. From inside that pyramid, 70 centuries look out at us, older than anything.
Yes, yes, all right, said Tepikaimon. No need to get carried away. He was a man, just like all of us.
And Kuft the camel herder looked upon the valley, Dil began. After 7,000 years, he will be wanting to look upon it again, said
Ashk-Ur-Men-Tep bluntly.
Even so, said the king, it does seem a bit.
The dead are equal, said Ashk-Ur-Men-Tep. You, young man, call him forth.
Who, me? Said Gurn. But he was the first.
Yes, we've been through all that, said Tepikaimon. Do it. Everyone's getting impatient. So is he, I expect.
Gurn rolled his eyes and hefted the hammer. Just as it was about to hiss down on the seal, Dil darted forward, causing Gurn to dance wildly across the ground in a groin-straining effort to avoid interring the hammer in his master's head.
It's open, said Dil. Luke, the seal just swings aside.
You mean he is out?
Tepikaimon tottered forward and grabbed the door of the pyramid. It moved quite easily. Then he examined the stone beneath it. Derelict and half-covered though it was, someone had taken care to keep a pathway clear to the pyramid, and the stone was quite worn away, as by the passage of many feet. This was not, by the nature of things, the normal state of affairs for a pyramid. The whole point was that once you were in, you were in. The mummies examined the worn entrance and creaked at one another in surprise. One of the very ancient ones, who was barely holding himself together, made a noise like Death Watch beetle finally conquering a rotten tree.
"What did he say?"
said Tepikaimon. The mummy of Ashk-Mentep translated.
"He said it is spooky,"
he croaked. The late king nodded. "I'm going to have a look. You two live ones, you come with me." Dil's face fell. "Oh, come on, man," snapped Tepikaimon, forcing the door back. "Look, I'm not frightened. Show a bit of backbone. Everyone else is."
"But we'll need some light,"
protested Dil. The nearest mummies lurched back sharply as Gurn timidly took a tinderbox out of his pocket.
"We'll need something to burn," said Dil.
The mummies shuffled further back, muttering.
"There's torches in here," said Tepikaimon, his voice slightly muffled, "and you can keep them away from me, lad."
It was a small pyramid, mazeless, without traps, just a stone passage leading upwards. Tremulously, expecting at any moment to see unnamed terrors leap out at them, the embalmers followed the king into a small square chamber that smelled of sand. The roof was black with soot. There was no sarcophagus within, no mummy case, no terror, named or nameless. The centre of the floor was occupied by a raised block, with a blanket and a pillow on it. Neither of them looked particularly old. It was almost disappointing. Gurn craned to look round.
"Quite nice, really," he said. "Comfy."
"No," said Dil.
"Eh, Master King, look here," said Gurn, trotting over to one of the walls. "Look, someone's been scratching things. Look, all little lines all over the wall."
"And this wall," said the King, "and the floor. Someone's been counting. Every 10 have been crossed through, you see. Someone's been counting things. Lots of things."
He stood back.
"What things?" said Dil, looking behind him.
"Very strange," said the king. He leaned forward. "You can barely make out the inscriptions underneath."
"Can you read it, king?"
said Gurn, showing what Dil considered to be unnecessary enthusiasm.
"No, it's in one of the really ancient dialects. Can't make out a blessed hieroglyph," said Tepikaimon. "I shouldn't think there's a single person alive today who can read it."
"That's a shame," said Gurn.
"True enough," said the king, and sighed.
They stood in gloomy silence.
"So, perhaps we could ask one of the dead ones," said Gurn.
Gurn,"
said Dil, backing away. The king slapped the apprentice on the back, pitching him forward.
"Damn clever idea," he said. "We'll just go and get one of the real early ancestors."
"Oh," he sagged, "that's no good. No one will be able to understand them."
"Gurn," said Dil, his eyes growing wider.
"No, it's all right, king," said Gurn, enjoying the newfound freedom of thought. "Because the reason being, everyone understands someone. All we have to do is sort them out."
Bright lad," said the king.
"Gurn!"
They both looked at him in astonishment.
"You all right, master?" said Gurn. "You've gone all white."
Stuttered
Dil, rigid with terror.
"The what, master?
"He ought to have a lie down," said the king. "I know his sort, the artistic type, highly strung."
Dil took a deep breath.
"Look at the sodding torch, Gurn," he shouted.
They looked, without any fuss, turning its black ashes into dry straw. The torch was burning backwards. The old kingdom lay stretched out before Tepik, and it was unreal. He looked at you bastard, who had stuck his muzzle in a wayside spring and was making a noise like the last drop in the milkshake glass. You know, the bit you can't reach with the straw. You bastard looked real enough. There was nothing like a camel for looking really solid. But the landscape had an uncertain quality, as if it hadn't quite made up its mind to be there or not. Except for the Great Pyramid. It squatted in the middle distance, as real as the pin that nails a butterfly to a board. It was contriving to look extremely solid, as though it was sucking all the solidity out of the landscape into itself. Well, he was here, wherever here was. How did you kill a pyramid? And what would happen if you did? He was working on the hypothesis that everything would snap back into place, into the old kingdom's pool of recirculated time. He watched the gods for a while, wondering what the hell they were and how it didn't seem to matter. They looked no more real than the land over which they strode, about incomprehensible errands of their own. The world was no more than a dream. Tepic felt incapable of surprise. If 7 fat cows had wandered by, he wouldn't have given them a second glance. He remounted You Bastard and rode him, sloshing gently down the road. The fields on either side had a devastated look. The sun was finally sinking. The gods of the night and evening were prevailing over the daylight gods. But it had been a long struggle, and when you thought about all the things that would happen to it now, eaten by goddesses, carried on boats under the world, and so on, it was an odds-on chance that it wouldn't be seen again. No one was visible as he rode into the stable yard. You Bastard padded sedately to his stall and pulled delicately at a wisp of hay. He'd thought of something interesting about bivariant distributions. Tepic patted him on the flank, raising another cloud, and walked up the wide steps that led to the palace proper. Still there were no guards, no servants, no living soul. He slipped into his own palace like a thief in the day and found his way to Dill's workshop. It was empty, and looked as though a robber with very peculiar tastes had recently been at work in there. The throne room smelled like a kitchen, and by the looks of it, the cooks had fled in a hurry. The gold mask of the Kings of Djeli Baby, slightly buckled out of shape, had rolled into a corner. He picked it up, and on a suspicion, scratched it with one of his knives. The gold peeled away, exposing a silver-grey gleam. He'd suspected that. There simply wasn't that much gold around. The mask felt as heavy as lead because, well, it was lead. He wondered if it had ever been all gold, and which ancestor had done it, and how many pyramids it had paid for. It was probably very symbolic of something or other. Perhaps not even symbolic of anything, just symbolic, all by itself. One of the sacred cats was hiding under the throne. It flattened its ears and spat at Tepic as he reached down to pat it. That much hadn't changed, at least. Still no people. He padded across to the balcony. And there the people were, a great silent mass, staring across the river in the fading leaden light. As Tepic watched, a flotilla of boats and ferries set out from the near bank. We ought to have been building bridges, he thought, but we said that would be shackling the river. He dropped lightly over the balustrade onto the packed earth and walked down to the crowd, and the full force of its belief scythed into him. The people of Djeli Baby might have had conflicting ideas about their gods, but their belief in their kings had been unswerving for thousands of years. To Tepic, it was like walking into a vat of alcohol. He felt it pouring into him until his fingertips crackled, rising up through his body until it gushed into his brain, bringing not omnipotence, but the feeling of omnipotence, the very strong sensation that while he didn't actually know everything, he would do soon and had done once. It had been like this back in Ankh, when the divinity had hooked him. But that had just been a flicker. Now it had the solid power of real belief behind it. He looked down at a rustling below him and saw green shoots springing out of the dry sand around his feet. Bloody hell, he thought. I really am a god. This could be very embarrassing. He shouldered his way through the press of people until he reached the riverbank and stood there in a thickening clump of corn. As the crowd caught on, those nearest fell to their knees, and a circle of reverentially collapsing people spread out from Tepic like ripples. But I never wanted this. I just wanted to help people live more happily, with plumbing. I wanted something done about run-down inner-city areas. I just wanted to put them at their ease and ask them how they enjoyed their lives. I thought schools might be a good idea so they wouldn't fall down and worship someone just because he's got green feet. And I wanted to do something about the architecture. As the light drained from the sky, like steel going cold, the pyramid was somehow even bigger than before. If you had to design something to give the very distinct impression of mass, the pyramid was it. There was a crowd of figures around it, unidentifiable in the grey light. Tepic looked around the prostrate crowd until he saw someone in the uniform of the palace guard.
"You, man, on your feet," he commanded.
The man gave him a look of dread, but did stagger sheepishly upright.
"What's going on here?"
"Oh, king, who is the lord of—"
"I don't think we have time," said Tepic. "I know who I am. I want to know what's happening."
"Oh, king, we saw the dead walking. The priests have gone to talk to them."
"The dead walking?"
"Yes, oh, king."
"We're not talking about not alive people here, are we?"
"Yes, oh, king."
"Oh, well, thank you. That was very succinct. Not informative, but succinct. Are there any boats around?"
"The priests took them all, oh, king."
Tepic could see that this was true. The jetties near the palace were usually thronged with boats, and now they were all empty. As he stared at the water, it grew two eyes and a long snout, to remind him that swimming in the Dajel was as feasible as nailing fog to the wall. He stared at the crowd. Every person was watching him expectantly, convinced that he would know what to do next. He turned back to the river, extended his hands in front of him, pressed them together, and then opened them gently. There was a damp, sucking noise, and the waters of the Dajel parted in front of him. There was a sigh from the crowd, but their astonishment was nothing to the surprise of a dozen or so crocodiles who were left trying to swim in 10 feet of air. Tepic ran down the bank and over the heavy mud, dodging to avoid the tails that slashed wildly at him as the reptiles dropped heavily onto the riverbed. The Dajel loomed up as two khaki walls, so that he was running along a damp and shadowy alley. Here and there were fragments of bones, old shields, bits of spear, the ribs of boats. He leapt and jinked around the debris of centuries. Ahead of him, a big bull crocodile propelled itself dreamily out of the wall of water, flailed madly in mid-air, and flopped into the ooze. Tepic trod heavily on its snout and plunged on. Behind him, a few of the quicker citizens, seeing the dazed creatures below them, began to look for stones. The crocodiles had been undisputed masters of the river since primordial times, but if it was possible to do a little catching up in the space of a few minutes, it was certainly worth a try. The sound of the monsters of the river beginning the long journey to Handbaghood broke out behind Tepic as he sloshed up the far bank. A line of ancestors stretched across the chamber, down the dark passageway, and out into the sand. It was filled with whispers going in both directions, a dry sound like the wind blowing through old paper. Dill lay on the sand, with Gurn flapping a cloth in his face.
"What are they doing?" he murmured.
"Reading the inscription," said Gurn. "You ought to see it, master. The one doing the reading, he's practically—"
"Yes, yes, all right," said Dill, struggling up.
"He's more than 6,000 years old. And his grandson's listening to him and telling his grandson, and he's telling his grandson—"
"Yes, yes, all right. And Kuft too said unto the first, 'What may we give unto you who has taught us the right ways?'" said Tepikaimon, who was at the end of the line. But not immediately, of course, because messages change in the telling, and some ancestors were not capable of perfect enunciation, and others were trying to be helpful and supplying what they thought were lost words. The message received by Tepikaimon originally began, "Handcuffed to the bed, the aunt thirsted."
"And the first spake, and this he spake, 'Build for me a pyramid, that I may rest, and build it of these dimensions, that it be proper.' And thus it was done, and the name of the first was—"
But there was no name. It was just a babble of raised voices, arguments, ancient curse words, spreading along the line of desiccated ancestors like a spark along a powder trail, until it reached Tepikaimon, who exploded.